Okay, it's great to be back with you at GoldSeek.com Radio for another Gold Nugget segment with Rob Kirby from Kirby Analytics. Well, my next guest says that the markets are manipulated. Free markets, not with the Exchange Stabilization Fund, the most powerful institution in the country, if not the world, that tells even the almighty U.S. Fed what to do. It's a pleasure to welcome Rob Kirby in his debut appearance on GoldSeek.com Radio. He runs Kirby Analytics and top advisor to institutional investors. Welcome, Rob Kirby.
Nice to be with you, Chris.
Well, you know, let's start up today, if we could, with the Exchange Stabilization Fund. We were talking before this interview about this entity that not many folks read about, even in the gold crowd, and you've got some must-hear information about this entity and the related cabal.
Sure. Let's start at the beginning, Chris. The real nitty-gritty that I've come to learn about the Exchange Stabilization Fund, And I would recommend all your listeners to go to a website called marketskeptics.com. And marketskeptics.com was the creation of a chap by the name of Eric DeCarbonell. And Eric DeCarbonell, his great-grandfather was a fellow by the name of Frank Vanderlip. And Frank Vanderlip was one of the people who rode the secret train down to Jekyll Island back in the early 1900s, and he was one of the original framers of the Federal Reserve Act. So Mr. DeCarbonell has a history of knowing a fair amount about the inner workings of central banking it's hard to tell the difference between the Federal Reserve these days and the U.S. Treasury operations, because the two of them seem to work hand in hand in terms of their market operations their nefarious market operations. So anyway, Mr. DeCarbonell, he created a video series back about 3 years ago, a five-part video series. It's linked on his site, marketskeptics.com, and this five-part series is very powerful, and like I said, I'd recommend anybody watch it. And it basically cemented, or was the glue, the mortar that really erected the foundation, the bigger foundation of my understanding of the interplay between the U.S. Treasury acting with the Fed. The Exchange Stabilization Fund is a covert arm of the U.S. Treasury that does not publish any financial reports. It is beyond the purview of Congress. It answers to nobody but the President. The Secretary of the Treasury is charged with running it, and it answers to nobody but the President. So there's no congressional oversight of this. Historically, it's been documented that the Exchange Stabilization Fund operates in any market, including the equity markets, anything and everything. And they literally are not held to account of any laws as set out in the U.S. Constitution or the laws of land. And this entity was seeded. It was created in 1934. It was seeded originally with $3 billion. And if you want to think in terms of, a criminal enterprise that was set up in 1934, if you just use in your head some natural compounding with published inflation rates, you know that $3 billion in 1934 dollars is worth a considerable sum today, especially when you factor in the notion that these people pay no tax and they publish no financials. So anyway, this entity has grown to be an incredibly powerful financial entity, and as DeCarbonell's work points out, they are, at least in my view, they are without a doubt the most powerful financial entity on the planet.
Let's talk about just how powerful they are in the markets and what gives them their power. Now, you did mention this $3 billion, which is probably somewhere in the neighborhood of at least $100 billion today, and who knows how much larger. I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about the Exchange Stabilization Fund and how they manipulate interest rate swaps, as well as this direct connection that you alluded to with the U.S. Treasury Department.
Chris, when you're talking about the Exchange Stabilization Fund, you are talking about the U.S. Treasury. When the Exchange Stabilization Fund operates in markets, in any market, they use let's say, the good offices of the New York Federal Reserve, and specifically the New York Fed Trading Desk acts as the exclusive broker for the Exchange Stabilization Fund. So when the Exchange Stabilization Fund wants to operate in OTC swaps, or an OTC means over-the-counter swaps, and OTC swaps are nothing but, let's just call it, custom-designed bets on interest rates at a future date. And the OTC swaps, broken down into their constituents, are at the short end of the curve, they are FRAs, or future rate agreements, and then at the longer end of the curve, they are interest rate swaps. An FRA is a bet, basically a glorified bet on what a specific LIBOR rate is going to be somewhere between now and 1 year forward. And an interest rate swap is an exchange of fixed for floating interest rate payments. And interest rate swaps from 3 years to 10 years in duration typically almost always have a bond trade embedded in them, because these swaps, 3 to 10 years, interest rate swaps, 3 to 10 years, trade as a spread over U.S. government bonds. And that is why there is a bond trade embedded in the swap. Banks, when commercial banks or bank holding companies operate in the interest rate swap market, they are always going to be spreading. As in, they don't gamble on all-in rates. They don't gamble on the, like, if, for instance, if a 10-year bond is yielding 2.65 or 2.69, I think it is today, the bank that's going to trade or going to operate in the 10-year swap space, they aren't betting on the whole 2.69 absolute rate. What they're going to bet on is where banks trade credit, because banks all trade at a spread over where the government can basically borrow money. And the government, the yield curve of government bonds is referred to as the risk-free rate of risk-free rate of interest. And the theory behind that is always that governments will always at least print the money and give it back to you, so you're always safe to buy a government bond, because they have the power of taxation, they have the power to create money, and they're always going to at least print the money and give it back to you. Banks pay a premium to what the government can raise money at, and it's that spread that's managed when you trade interest rate swaps. And hence, there is a bond trade embedded when Bank A trades a 10-year swap with Bank B in the interbank market. The Bank B, if they're the receiver of the fixed rate, sells a notional amount of bonds in the cash market to the payer of fixed. And what happens when the Exchange Stabilization Fund comes into the market, they operate one way only. They operate as a receiver of all-in fixed rates, and they do not provide the fixed rate paying bank, spread playing bank, they do not provide them with the bonds to hedge their trade. This forces the spread paying bank into the cash bond market to buy bonds to hedge their trade. This creates phantom demand effectively for government bonds.
We thought we had the creature from Jekyll Island by our Federal Reserve and, of course, the Fed chair, who is essentially appointed and then has to give an occasional speech before Congress. That's who we thought was the nefarious Wizard of Oz pulling the strings. But in reality, he has a big brother. And this big brother has virtually no oversight whatsoever, with endless deep pockets. Can you tell us just what this means to the everyday investor? Are you essentially saying that the markets are rigged?
I'm saying the markets are rigged. I'm saying that interest rates and the level that we see interest rates at today is 100% arbitrary. It's not based in economics. Everything that economics teaches you is that the market rates of interest, or the risk-free rate of interest, call it the 10-year bond rate, the U.S. 10-year government bond rate, is supposed to be the real inflation rate plus about 250 points. And, you see, this is all part of why the government has to tell us that the inflation, they doctor the inflation statistics to tell us that inflation's running below 2%. If you go and look at the work of John Williams, who's a brilliant economist in his own right, and if you look at his work says that if we were measuring today the inflation rate the same way it was measured in 1980, instead of having inflation at 1.8 or 1.6%, we would indeed have an inflation rate close to 10%. By the metric I just mentioned, that would put 10-year government money, 10-year bond yield, call it 9.5% plus 250 points. That would be 12% 10-year money. So you see, they had to doctor the inflation number to make the inflation look like it didn't exist, and this way they can hopefully try to justify why 10-year bonds are at 2.95%. So, you know, like, the reality is they are completely and 100% arbitrarily set. They are set in the back rooms by people at the U.S. Treasury acting in concert with the Federal Reserve, and then the rates are forced to these levels by using interest rate derivatives, FRAs, and interest rate swaps. And U.S. monetary policy is executed with the Federal Reserve acting as broker and executed through the trading desks of what I like to refer to as the Magnificent Five. And that would be J.P. Morgan, Citibank, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley. Each one of these five cretinous institutions has a derivatives book in excess of $50 trillion notional. And these numbers are so staggering, Chris, like, you know, nobody will debate me on the size of their books. Nobody wants to talk about it.
Well, the irony of that is that you have just made an excellent segue into my next question for you. I was going to ask you about the top five U.S. banks and their 200 plus trillion in notional derivatives. Now, here's the big question, though. Derivatives are not necessarily de facto risky. However, interest rate derivatives are particularly so. What would you estimate their interest rate exposure, top five U.S. banks?
To begin with, Chris, you know, the number that you're looking at, you've probably gone to the quarterly derivatives report of the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. And you're probably looking, when you just gave me the aggregate number of 200 trillion in notional at the top five U.S. banks, that's actually a very misleading number. Because in the quarterly derivatives report, Chris, I think there's about 31 pages in those reports, roughly 31, it might be 32 pages. Every page but one gives you data on the top 25 commercial banks in the United States. But there's one page that gives you the total aggregates for the bank holding companies in the United States. And there's a big difference between the two. Because when you count bank holding companies, the total aggregate held by U.S. institutions goes from 200 trillion up to about 300 trillion. So the real number we're talking here is 300 trillion. And what's 100 trillion between the rest? The big difference there being, or the most pronounced difference between holding companies and commercial banks, is that Morgan Stanley trades all their derivatives in the name of the bank holding company, not the commercial bank. And their book is over 50 trillion. And then of Goldman Sachs' book, I believe it's 6 trillion additional. The commercial bank Goldman Sachs has a derivatives book, for instance, of 44 trillion, but at the holding company level it's 50. And you see, so the numbers that we get from the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency on in the quarterly derivatives reports, they are useful, but you have to understand that they aren't by any means complete.
Duly noted. With that in mind, though, I think you'd probably agree that the interest rate exposure is a key metric. Can you tell us what you estimate that to be out of the figure and just what it could mean if suddenly, oh, I don't know, the world lost faith and confidence in the U.S. dollar and some of those few trillions of dollars started to repatriate back to our shores?
Here's a great way to look at it. If you look at the total aggregates, The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency does tell us on a breakdown of percentages that 82% of all derivatives held by U.S. banks or banking entities, over 80% of this exposure is in interest rate contracts. And then interest rate contracts would be broken down into OTC swaps, which is the lion's share of that 82% of the aggregate. But it would also have such things as exchange-traded futures like euro-dollar futures, and it would have things like options on euro-dollar futures. So there is a segment of it that's exchange-traded, but the amount of this stuff that is the amount of this stuff that's traded OTC is by far the lion's share of it, and measuring the risk in it. I used to be an institutional broker in this stuff back in the 80s, and back in the 80s, I was a broker to an institution called Citibank Canada Toronto, and Citibank Canada Toronto is where these instruments were incubated back in the 80s, and there's a bit of a story as to why they were developed and incubated in Canada, but it had something to do with our Bank Act and the protectionism by Canadian banks. But in any case, these instruments were incubated in Canada, and Citibank Canada was the clearinghouse for Citibank Worldwide in the 80s in derivative instruments. The variability I know in my client's position on a volatile day in the interest rate universe, he could have swings in his P&L of many, many millions of dollars. And I'm talking like on a book size that probably would have been measured in the hundreds of billions. So all I'm saying is it's a percentage. You can have variability because these interest rate derivatives are dynamic. And because most banks will tell you that they are somewhat hedged when they put these trades on, and then as the market gets crazy and if interest rates start whipping around, the value of the hedges change. And you see, so like to think that if you had a $50 trillion derivatives book, to think that you could have a 1% variability in the value of that book on a very, very upsetting day in the marketplace, 1% of $50 trillion is $500 billion, and that's more than the market capitalization of any U.S. bank.
Okay, let's bring this back then, if we could. I'd like to know just how this exchange stabilization fund manages, you say, not only interest rates, but our equities markets and even the precious metals markets, please.
Chris, interest rates and specifically the price of gold, are historically co-joined at the hip, and don't have to take my word for it. You can take the word of a former U.S. Treasury Secretary by the name of Lawrence Summers. Mr. Summers did academic work as a professor at Harvard University back in the 1980s. He penned a paper called Gibson's Paradox and the Gold Standard with a fellow professor at the time at Harvard.
Exactly. It shows that when we have negative interest rates, we tend to have very bullish gold markets. It's quite a famous paper in the industry. Yep.
It makes the connection between making the philosophical argument or discussion that you wouldn't be able to rig rates down unless you could rig the price of gold down too, because the gold price would effectively serve as the canary in the coal mine and would start squawking that something is amiss in the interest rate market. And you see, this is what gold has been trying to do for the past 15 or 20 years, and it's been short-circuited. It's been short-circuited through floods of paper gold selling on exchanges like the COMEX exchange and through the London Bullion Market Association, where promises of gold are sold in lieu of actual physical gold itself.
But if that's the case, has the canary stopped chirping? Has it fallen off the perch? How much time is left before, the natural forces, the invisible hand, as Adam Smith would call it, exerts influence over these markets?
Chris, what this has served to do is, when you run a skimming operation, Chris, and I sort of can equate this a little bit to a skimming operation. When you run a skimming operation and you skim a little bit, sometimes not everybody in the room gets it or notices. But when the skimming operation becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, people around you start to notice. And the rest of the world has really started to notice, particularly the Asians, particularly China. They're very aware, and the Germans, I think, are also very aware now, as are the Russians. They're extremely aware of what America's been doing in terms of turning our capital markets into forgeries of what they're supposed to be. And you see, this is why China has been, in the last 2 or 3 years, I think they've completed something like 22 or 23 bilateral swap agreements totaling like $2.5 trillion roughly with fellow trading partners, with the expressed point of excluding U.S. dollars from global trade settlement.
And then I know the listener out there is scratching their head saying, we've read these reports. Chris has been talking about it. His guests have been talking about it. All of these interconnections away from the dollar, agreements with Iran between China, agreements throughout the BRIC nations. Then how is it that this U.S. dollar continues to keep from breaking below that key 70-71 point?
Through derivatives. It's held up because, to a large extent, Chris, banks that play in these derivatives become dollar junkies, because the act of doing these trades mean that the banks involved in them need dollars. And it's not just U.S. banks that are involved in the derivatives markets. You see, because as we said earlier, like the Bank for International Settlements, they also put out derivative statistics, and they tell us that global derivatives total of around $750 trillion, I think the last time I saw their numbers. And we've just established earlier that American banks only make up $300 trillion of that. So that means there's another $350 trillion that would be spread out among, let's just say, some British banks, probably some Japanese banks, probably at least one German bank, like namely Deutsche, Hong Kong Shanghai Bank. There'd be a couple of French banks. There's probably a big Dutch bank. And these guys all have books in the trillions, many tens of trillions also. And the fact that they have these books and they have commitments in dollars means that all of these banks of all these different nationalities can't just drop dollars, because they're contractually committed. By, like, when you do a 10-year swap with a counterparty, you have an exchange of dollar-denominated funds for the next 10 years. So you just can't drop the dollar and say we're not going to do dollars anymore, because you're obligated.
If it's true, as you say, that gold is being manipulated lower as well as interest rates, if we do start to see a significant increase or pickup in interest rates, it would seem that that might not crush the precious metals as much as one would expect, that we could actually see, as we did in the 70s, interest rates inch up sharply along with the precious metals markets.
Interest rates are never going appreciably higher. And you know, like we might see the 10-year drift up to 3%. It might drift up to 3% again. But I'm even thinking that's probably not likely now either, because you see, through the interest rate swap mechanism, they have the ability to make the 10-year bond yield anything they want it to be. You see, in days gone by, Chris, there was these people known as bond vigilantes, and bond vigilantes used to inflict discipline on the bond market. If they saw government spending or printing too much money, they would sell their debt and they would raise the level of interest that the government had to pay, which would curb the government's spendthriftness. But you see, the bond vigilantes are as extinct. They died like 10, 15 years ago. They were all wiped out, because what they did when they saw the government turning on the reckless fiscal, perpetual fiscal deficits, they started to sell the bonds. And that's when the exchange stabilization fund stepped in, and they realized that they could combat these people by doing these interest rate swaps with the banks in the marketplace, which would turn the banks into captive buyers of U.S. government debt to the tune of any amount they want them to be. So you see, they basically had their debt problem solved. And this is why, Chris, if you read the memoirs of Paul O'Neill when he was talked to by Dick Cheney back in the early 00s, he went to O'Neill and he said, "Deficits don't matter anymore. It's our due. We can spend whatever we want." You see, Cheney, as the consummate backroom guy, he knew that they had the ability to make the amount of spending that the U.S. government was doing irrelevant, and that they could control interest rates. You see, but this is why it's the rigging of rates, this is what's at the root of all the problems in the world. This is why America isn't very popular with many players around the world today. This is why China wants gold.
Speaking of gold, I wonder if you could tell folks specifically your thoughts on just what all of this could mean to the precious metals markets, and is it a positive in the long term for precious metals investors?
With this kind of knowledge, Chris, if anybody invests the time to understand what's really going on, you will come to realize that the price of gold and the price of precious metals in general are metaphorically like a beach ball being held on the bottom of a pool. And I'll tell you something, the people that are holding the beach ball on the bottom of the pool, they are going to have to come up for air at some point in time, because what they're doing is not sustainable. And when it pops, it's going to pop big.
Is it possible to even forecast what that means in terms of nominal prices?
No, actually, Chris, I'm going to throw a term at you, a reversion to a mean. If you put the last 3,000 years on a yardstick, and if you talk about the amount of time that we've had a pure fiat money standard in the world, you probably have maybe an inch or 2 inches of that 36-inch yardstick where we've had a fiat standard. The rest of the yardstick wealth was measured in ounces. And for many and most of those inches on the yardstick, a very good middle-class wage was somewhere between 40 and 60 ounces of silver. So I think I'm going to live to see the day when 40 to 60 ounces of silver will be a good middle-class wage once again. So why don't you tell me what the price of silver is going to be?
You're talking about four digits. When would you suppose that we left the precious metal standard? I mean, there's so many ways we can look at this. I mean, you can argue that it was Roosevelt. You can even go back to the Federal Reserve. Some people say it was Nixon in 71. Others have said, well, not until most of our 90% silver left circulation were we really off of a gold and silver standard. I'd like your thoughts.
I would suggest we were, in a North American sense, actually probably really in a global sense, was with the gold confiscation in, 1933 or 4. And that to me was an attempt to basically kill the gold standard. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just something that hasn't worked. You see, the current fiat standard, Chris, is going to fail. I can't tell you what day it's going to fail, but I know it will fail. And when it fails, things are going to be thrown into such disarray that that people will look for, will end up being forced back to going to things that have worked in the past.
Should we be thinking in terms of that mighty island nation, Great Britain, when its pound no longer was the de facto currency? Or are we looking at something far worse, more sinister? Because this time around, there is virtually not a single currency in circulation backed by anything more than paper promises.
Exactly.
So, you referred earlier to Mr. John Williams, a regular and favorite on this show. He thinks precious metals have much room on the upside. He says, Chris, what is a one divided by zero? Because essentially, we're looking at an infinity if you look at where paper money ultimately has to go, which is zero.
Well, it's a hyperinflation.
This term hyperinflation has been thrown around so carelessly. Can you undo some of that damage? I mean, everyone has kind of given up, I think, on the mega inflation theme. Is that going to work to their detriment?
Well, you know what, Chris? I can say this because I've done a little bit of research in the area of hyperinflations. Most hyperinflations, and there's been like hundreds of them, like throughout recorded history. And the one thing they all have in common is that, to characterize them, when they come, they always seem like a lightning bolt out of a clear blue sky, and they come on extremely quickly.
Of course, the Weimar is maybe the most prominent example, but certainly not the worst. I mean, we can talk about Hungary, Czechoslovakia, well, virtually every Central European country.
It's interesting, Chris, you reference Weimar Germany. Why do you think Germany wants their gold back?
That may only be one component, the swapping and interest rate schemes that have gone on there, and they realize that their gold has been rehypothecated probably several times over. Because I think they realize that deflation is what we're afraid of, because that's all we've experienced, at least since the Civil War. But inflation is far more nefarious, and it just devastates the middle and working classes.
Absolutely. And you can also rest assured, Chris, it's been the dirty tricks of the Anglo-American banking establishment in an attempt to keep the current system operating, which has enraged German politicians to the point where an adjunct of the German finance ministry called Baffin has now undertaken their own investigation. They've been investigating now for well over a year. And these guys are fiercely independent, and I'm told that these guys, when they have the goods, they will act. And, you know, I think the world will be better served if we end up with a slew of high-profile indictments and a roundup.
Well, you know, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts has gone on record recently. Paris sent back 37 tons. They're finished. Why is it that we're stretching this out over so many years and not making good on our promise? And he draws the inference, is it possible we really don't have the gold? I mean, the physical gold may be there. But our officials recognize that it is simply leased and swapped so many times over that it would send the markets into chaos if we really had to send back 1,500 tons in total. So do you care to put a timeline on this? How long can they hold this inflated beach ball underwater? You say they have to come up for breath.
I've said this before publicly. And you know, I'll say it again because I think it's relevant, and I think it's on the mark. China has been aggressively accumulating gold, and I'll tell you something, Chris. China has a protocol when they do their procurement of gold. Every bar or every ounce of gold that China accumulates is de facto automatically recast and re-refined. Their preferred way of holding gold is in kilo bars. And the reason why they have everything re-refined is because the people advising China have encountered product in the marketplace that isn't gold. It's made of tungsten. You know, I've written about this years ago. And I wrote about this years ago because I know somebody who's in the procurement business internationally. And somebody tried to sell them 50 tons of tungsten. And this person is a very streetwise person and knew that there was something wrong with the supposed goods. There's a lot of tungsten gold siloed in places in our international market.
Well, you know, for our listeners, this is just a bit of anecdotal information, but if you purchase silver bars, you don't have to worry about that. Just take one of those rare earth small magnets, round magnets, and if it rolls just a bit more slowly off of a 100-ounce bar of silver, you can be sure that you have the real thing, because silver is, interestingly enough, slightly magnetic in nature, whereas lead has no magnetic qualities or minuscule. So this is a neat little trick that I've learned over the years, that you can check all of your Engelhard and Johnson Matthey bars quickly with a 10-cent rare earths magnet. If it rolls slowly, then it's silver. If it rolls off quickly, you may have a lead bar.
One more thing I just wanted to throw in on top of that. People would also be wise to pay attention that the gold that Germany, the pittance that they have been managed to get back.
Yeah, 5 tons.
They've recast it. They've recast it all. What I would like to mention to people is that the people advising the Germans are the same people that are advising the Chinese.
Can you tell folks more about the services that you provide? Any blogs, websites, or any contact information you'd like to leave with the listeners today?
Yeah, well, you can find me on the web at KirbyAnalytics.com. I tend to, in recent months, Chris, I've been writing a lot less publicly, as in trying not to write publicly, and I've been trying to communicate directly with my clients. So. And I'm also involved in the bullion business. I'm a sales agent for a company named BMG, Bullion Management.
We're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio.
And I look forward to it, Chris. Nice to have had the time with you.